Listening Library presents Once Upon a Time in the North by Philip Pullman. Read for you by the author and a full cast. The battered cargo balloon came in out of a rainstorm over the White Sea, losing height rapidly and swaying in the strong northwest wind as the pilot trimmed the vanes and tried to adjust the gas valve. The pilot was a lean young man with a large hat, a laconic disposition, and a thin moustache, and at present he was making for the Barents Sea Company depot, whose location was marked on a torn scrap of paper pinned to the binnacle of the gondola. He could see the depot spread out around the little harbour ahead, a cluster of administrative buildings, a hangar, a warehouse, workshops, gas storage tanks, and the associated machinery. It was all approaching fast, and he had to make quick adjustments to everything he could control in order to avoid the hangar roof and make for the open space beyond the warehouse. The gas valve was stuck. It needed a wrench, but the only tool to hand was a dirty old revolver, which the pilot hauled from the holster at his waist and used to bang the valve till it loosened all at once, releasing more gas than he really wanted. The balloon sagged and drooped suddenly and plunged downwards, scattering a group of men clustered around a broken tractor. The gondola smashed into the hard ground and bounced and dragged behind the emptying balloon across the open space until it finally came to rest only feet away from a gas storage tank. The pilot gingerly untangled his fingers from the rope he'd been holding on to, worked out which way up he was, shifted the toolbox off his legs, wiped the oily water out of his eyes, and hauled himself upright.
"Well, Hester, looks like we're getting the hang of this."
His demon, who looked like a small sardonic jackrabbit, flicked her ears as she clambered out of the tangle of tools, cold-weather clothing, broken instruments and rope. Everything was saturated.
"My feelings are too deep to express, Lee."
Lee found his hat and emptied the rainwater out of it before settling it on his head. Then he became aware of the audience, the men by the tractor, two workers at the gas plant, one clasping his hands to his head after the near escape, and a shirt-sleeved clerk from the administrative building gaping in the open doorway. Lee gave them a cheerful wave and turned back to make the balloon safe. He was proud of this balloon. He'd won it in a poker game 6 months before in Texas. He was 24, ready for adventure, and happy to go wherever the winds took him. He'd better be, as Hester reminded him. He wasn't going to go anywhere else. Blown by the winds of chance, then, and very slightly aided by the first half of a tattered book called The Elements of Aerial Navigation, which his opponent in the poker game had thrown in free, the second half was missing, he had drifted into the Arctic, stopping wherever he could find work, and eventually landed on this island. Novi Odense looked like a place where there was work to be done, and Lee's pockets were well nigh empty. He worked for an hour or two to make everything secure, and then, assuming the nonchalance proper to a prince of the air, he sauntered over to the administrative building to pay for the storage of the balloon.
"You come here for the oil?"
said the clerk behind the counter.
"He came here for flying lessons,"
said a man sitting by the stove drinking coffee.
"Oh, yeah,"
said the clerk.
"We saw you land. Impressive."
"What kind of oil would that be?"
said Lee.
"Ah,"
said the clerk, winking.
"All right, you're kidding. I got it. You heard nothing from me about any oil rush. I could tell you were a roughneck, but I won't say a word. You working for Larsen Manganese?"
"I'm an aeronaut. That's why I have a balloon. You going to give me a receipt for that?"
"Here,"
said the clerk, stamping it and handing it over. Lee tucked it into his waistcoat pocket and said,
"What's Larsen Manganese?"
"Big, rich mining company." "You rich?"
"Does it look like it?"
"No."
"Well, you got that right. Anything else I got to do before I go and spend all my money?"
"Customs. Over by the main gate."
Lee found the Customs and Revenue Office easily enough, and filled in a form under the instructions of a stern young officer.
"I see you have a gun,"
the officer said.
"Is that against the law?"
"No." "Are you working for Larsen Manganese?"
"I've only been here 5 minutes, and already two people asked me that. I never heard of Larsen Manganese before I landed here."
"Lucky. Open your kit bag, please."
Lee offered it and its meager contents for inspection. It took about 5 seconds.
"Thank you, Mr. Scoresby. It would be a good idea to remember that the only legitimate agency of the law here on Novi Odense is the Office of Customs and Revenue. There is no police force. That means that if anyone transgresses the law, we deal with it. And let me assure you that we do so without hesitation.
Glad to hear it. Give me a law-abiding place any day.
He swung his kit bag over his shoulder and set out for the town. It was late spring and the snow was dirty and the road pitted with potholes. The buildings in the town were mostly of wood, which must have been imported since few trees grew on the island. The only exceptions he could see were built of some dark stone that gave a dull, disapproving air to the town centre. A glum-looking oratory dedicated to St. Petronius, a town hall, and a bank. Despite the blustery wind, the town smelt richly of its industrial products. There were refineries for fish oil, seal oil, and rock oil. There was a tannery and a fish-pickling factory, and various effluvia from all of them assailed Lee's nose or stung his eyes as the wind brought their fragrance down the narrow streets. The most interesting thing was the bears. The first time Lee saw one slouching casually out of an alley, he could scarcely believe his eyes. Gigantic, ivory-furred, silent. The creature's expression was impossible to read, but there was no mistaking the immense power in those limbs, those claws, that air of inhuman self-possession. There were more of them further into town, gathered in small groups at street corners, sleeping in alleyways, and occasionally working, pulling a cart or lifting blocks of stone on a building site. The townspeople took no notice of them, except to avoid them on the pavement. They didn't look at them either, Lee noticed.
They want to pretend they're not there,
said Hester. For the most part, the bears ignored the people, but once or twice Lee saw a glance of sullen anger in a pair of small, intense black eyes, or heard a low and quickly suppressed growl as a well-dressed woman stood expectantly waiting to be made way for. But both bears and people stepped aside when a couple of men in a uniform of maroon came strolling down the center of the pavement. They wore pistols and carried batons, and Lee supposed them to be customs men. All in all, the place was suffused with an air of tension and anxiety. Lee was hungry, so he chose a cheap-looking bar and ordered vodka and some pickled fish. The place was crowded and the air was rank with smoke leaf. And unless they were unusually excitable in this town, there was something in the nature of a quarrel going on. Voices were raised in the corner of the room, someone was banging his fist on a table, and the bartender was watching closely, paying only just enough attention to his job to refill Lee's glass without being asked. Lee knew that one sure way to get into trouble of his own was to inquire too quickly into other people's. So he didn't give more than a swift glance at the area where the voices were raised. But he was curious, too, and once he'd made a start on the pickled fish, he said to the bartender,
"What's the discussion about over there?"
"That red-haired bastard Van Breda can't set sail and leave. He's a Dutchman with a ship tied up in the harbour, and they won't release his cargo from the warehouse. He's been driving everyone mad with his complaining. If he doesn't shut up soon, I'm going to throw him out."
"Oh, why won't they release the cargo?"
"I don't know. Probably he hasn't paid the storage fee. Who cares?"
"Well, I guess he does."
He turned round in a leisurely way and rested his elbows on the bar behind him. The man with the red hair was about 50, stocky and high-coloured, and when one of the other men at the table tried to put a hand on his arm, he shook it off violently, upsetting a glass. Seeing what he'd done, the Dutchman put both hands to his head in a gesture that looked more like despair than fury. Then he tried placating the man whose beer he'd spilt, but that went wrong too, and he banged both fists on the table and shouted through the hubbub.
"Such a frenzy,"
said a voice beside Lee.
"He'll work himself into a heart attack, wouldn't you say?"
Lee turned to see a thin, hungry-looking man in a faded black suit that was a little too big for him.
"Could be."
"Are you a stranger here, sir?"
"Just flew in."
"An aeronaut! How exciting! Well, things are really looking up in Novyodense. Stirring times."
"I hear they've struck oil."
"Indeed. The town is positively palpitating with excitement. And there's to be an election for mayor this very week. There hasn't been so much news in Novyodense for years and years."
"An election, eh? And who are the candidates?"
"The incumbent mayor who will not win, and a very able candidate called Ivan Dmitrovich Polyakov, who will. He's on the threshold of a great career. He will really put our little town on the map. He will use the mayoralty as a stepping stone to a seat in the Senate at Novgorod, and then, who knows? He will be able to take his anti-bear campaign all the way to the mainland. But you, sir, what has inspired your visit to Novyodense?"
"I'm looking for innocent employment. As you say, I'm an aeronaut by profession.
He noticed the other man's glance, which had strayed to the belt under Lee's coat. In leaning back against the bar, Lee had let the coat fall away to reveal the pistol he kept at his waist, which an hour or two before had done duty as a hammer.
And a man of war, I see.
Oh, no. Every fight I've been in, I tried to run away from. This is just a matter of personal decoration. Hell, I ain't even sure I know how to fire this, what is it? Revolvelator or something?
You're a man of wit as well.
Tell me something. Just now you mentioned an anti-bear campaign. Now, I've just come here through the town, and I couldn't help noticing the bears. That's a curious thing to me, because I never seen creatures like that before. They just free to roam around as they please?
The thin man picked up his empty glass and elaborately tried to drain it before setting it back down on the bar with a sigh.
Oh, now let me fill that for you.
Oh.
It's warm work explaining things to a stranger. What are you drinking?
The bartender produced a bottle of expensive cognac, to Lee's resigned amusement and a click of annoyance from Hester's throat.
Very kind, sir, very kind,
said the thin man, whose butterfly demon opened her resplendent wings once or twice on his shoulder.
Allow me to introduce myself. Oscar Sigurdsson is my name, poet and journalist. And you, sir?
Lee Scoresby, aeronaut for hire.
They shook hands.
You were telling me about bears,
prompted Lee, after a look at his own glass, which was nearly empty and would have to remain so.
Yes, indeed. Worthless vagrants. Bears these days are sadly fallen from what they were. Once they had a great culture, you know. Brutal, of course, but noble in its own way. One admires the true savage, uncorrupted by softness and ease. Several of our great sagas recount the deeds of the Bear Kings. I myself am working, have been for some time, on a poem in the old meters, which will tell of the fall of Ragnar Lokesson, the last great king of Svalbard. I would be glad to recite it for you.
Nothing I'd like more. I'm mighty partial to a good yarn.
In the time of...
But maybe another time. Tell me about the bears I saw out in the streets.
Vagrants, as I say. Scavengers, drunkards, many of them. Degraded specimens, every one. They steal, they drink, they lie and cheat.
They lie?
You can depend on it.
You mean they speak?
Oh, yes. You didn't know? They used to be fine craftsmen, too. Skillful workers in metal. But not this generation. All they can manage now is coarse welding, rough work of that kind. The armor they have now is crude, ugly.
Armor?
Not allowed to wear it in town, of course. They make it, you know, a piece at a time as they grow older. By the time they're fully mature, they have the full set. But, as I say, it's rough, crude stuff, with none of the finesse of the great period. The fact is that nowadays they're merely parasites, the dregs of a dying race. And it would be better for us all if...
He never finished his sentence, because at that point the bartender had had enough of the Dutchman's troubles and came out from behind the bar with a heavy stick in his hand. Warned by the faces around him, the captain stood up and half-turned unsteadily, his face a dull red, his eyes glittering, and spread his hands. But the bartender raised his stick and was about to bring it down when Lee moved. He sprang between the two men, seized the captain's wrists, and said,
"Now, Mr. Bartender, you don't need to hit a man when he's drunk. There's a better way to deal with this kind of thing. Come on, Captain. There's fresh air outside. This place is bad for your complexion."
"What the hell is this to do with you?"
the bartender shouted.
"Why, I'm the captain's guardian angel. You want to put that stick down?"
"I'll put it down on your goddamn head!"
Lee dropped the captain's wrists and turned to face the bartender squarely.
"You try that and see what happens next."
Silence in the bar. No one moved. Even the captain only blinked and looked blurrily at the tense little standoff in front of him. Lee was perfectly ready to fight, and the bartender could see it, and after a few moments he lowered the stick and growled sullenly.
"You two, get out!"
"Just what me and the captain had in mind. Now stand aside."
He took the captain's arm and guided the man out through the crowded barroom. As the door swung shut behind them, he heard the bartender call,
"And don't come back!"
The captain swayed and leaned against the wall, and then blinked again and focused his eyes.
"Who are you? No, I don't care who you are. Go to hell."
He stumbled away. Lee watched him go and scratched his head.
We've been here less than an hour,
said Hester.
And you already got us thrown out of a bar.
Yep, another successful day. But damn, Hester, you don't hit a drunk man with a stick.
Find a bed, Lee. Keep still. Don't talk to anyone. Think good thoughts. Stay out of trouble.
That's a good idea,
said Lee. A few inquiries brought him to a dingy boarding house near the harbour. He paid the landlady for a week's room and board, and laid his kit bag on the bed before going out to seek a way of earning some money. There was a brisk wind snapping in from the sea, and Lee pulled his coat around him and settled his hat more firmly on his head as he came out of a side street onto the harbour front. He found a line of shops facing the water, a ship's chandler, a clothing store and the like, and a dingy bar or two, and the broad, stone-built headquarters of the Provincial Customs and Revenue Authority, with a navy and white flag flying from the roof. From each end of this waterfront, a quay stretched out ahead, forming a long, sheltered harbour 150 yards or so wide. At the far end stood a lighthouse on a headland that curved around from the right. Lee looked at the boats in the harbour, taking stock. For a town in the throes of an oil rush, it didn't seem very busy. There was a coal tanker tied up at the quay on the right, sitting low in the water, so they hadn't unloaded her yet. And the only crane on that side was a big steam affair that was working to set a new mainmast in a bark, attended by more men than were necessary, each vividly expressing his point of view. It would take all day. The coal would have to wait. On the other quay, to the left, there were two smaller Anbarrick cranes, the first busy loading barrels of fish oil into the hold of one small steam coaster, the second unloading the timber piled high on the deck of another. Beyond them lay a schooner, at which no activity of any sort was going on, and Lee guessed that to be the unfortunate Captain Van Breda's vessel that couldn't load her cargo. Lee couldn't even see anyone on deck. The ship had a forlorn air. Running along each quay was a line of stone-built warehouses, and at the near end of the left-hand quay was a cluster of offices, including that of the harbour master. There was a pilot's launch tied up at the steps outside it, and a substantial steam tug a little further on. And if neither of those was busy, trade must be slow. Lee rang the bell at the harbour master's office and went in, having read the brass plate beside the door.
Good day to you, Mr. Argard. I've come to see whether I can find any work around here. Scoresby is the name, and I have a cargo balloon in storage at the Barrett Sea Company Depot. Any likelihood of an aeronaut services being in demand, do you suppose?
The harbour master was an elderly man with a sour and cautious expression. His cat demon opened her eyes briefly and closed them again in disdain.
Business is slow, Mr. Scoresby. We have 4 vessels working in the harbour, and when they have gone, I do not expect any more trade for a week. Times are bad.
4 vessels? My eyes must be deceiving me. I saw 5.
4.
Then my eyes do need fixing. I saw 3-masted hallucination at the end of the East Quay.
There is no work at the East Quay or at the West. Good day, Mr. Scoresby.
And good day to you, sir.
He and Hester left. Lee rubbed his jaw and looked left, along the quay, to the still schooner.
I don't like to see any vessel so quiet. She looks like a ghost ship. There ought to be something the crew could be doing. Well, let's go and see what price they charge for hemp cord.
He strolled along to the chandlery, where at least the stink of fish oil and tanning skins gave way to that of clean, tarred rope. The man behind the counter was reading a newspaper, and he barely looked up when Lee came in.
Good day,
said Lee, to no response. He wandered about the shop, looking at everything, and as usual saw plenty he needed and little he could afford. He scratched his head at the prices until he remembered that this place was an ice-bound island for 6 months of the year, and everything had to be imported.
How's the election going?
He said to the shopkeeper, nodding at his newspaper.
Will Mr. Polyakov become the new mayor?
You want to buy something?
Maybe. Ain't seen anything I can afford at your prices.
Well, I don't sell newspapers.
Then good day to you,
said Lee, and left. He turned up into the town. The blue sky of morning had gone, and a bitter wind was bringing grey clouds scudding across from the north. There were only 3 people in sight, 2 women with shopping baskets and an old man with a stick. A group of bears stopped their rumbling conversation and watched him as he went past before beginning again. Their voices so low he almost felt them through the soles of his feet.
This is the bleakest, smelliest, most unfriendliest damn place we ever set foot in.
I wouldn't argue with you, Lee.
Something'll turn up, though.
But nothing turned up that afternoon. The evening meal was served in the parlour of the boarding house, which was a dismal place with a small dining table, an iron stove, a shelf of religious books, and a small collection of battered and dusty board games with names like Peril of the Pole, Flippity Flop, and Animal Misfits. The meal itself consisted of a mutton stew and an apple pie. The pie was tolerable. Lee's fellow boarders were a photographer from Oslo, an official from the Institute of Economics in Novgorod, and a young lady called Miss Victoria Lund, who worked in the public library. She was as pretty as a picture, if it was a picture of a high-minded young woman of unyielding rectitude and severity. She was tall, and on the bony side of slim, and her fair hair was tightly pulled back into a bun. Her long-sleeved white blouse was buttoned to the neck. She was the first young woman Lee had spoken to for a month.
"So, you're a librarian, Miss Lund. What kind of books do the people of Novi Odense like to read?"
"Various kinds."
"I might look in myself tomorrow, see if I can find out some information. There's a book called The Elements of Aerial Navigation I'd really like to finish reading. Where's your library, Miss Lund?"
"In Olin Square."
"Right, Olin Square. You been working there long?"
"No."
"I see. So you're, newly qualified, I guess."
"Yes."
"And is Novi Odense your hometown?"
"No."
"Then I guess we're both strangers here, huh?"
That brought no response, but her swallow demon looked at Hester from the back of her chair, spread his wings wide, and then closed them again, followed by his eyes. But Lee persevered.
"Would you care for some of this pie, Miss Lund?"
"Thank you."
"You know, right after supper, I thought I'd take a stroll along the waterfront and see what the enterprising citizens of Novi Odense have to offer in the way of nighttime entertainment. I don't suppose you'd care to accompany me."
"No, I would not."
Miss Lund left the table immediately the meal was over, and as soon as she was gone, the other two men laughed and clapped Lee on the shoulder.
15,
said the photographer.
"I made it 14,
said the economist.
"But you win."
14 what?
Words you got out of her. I bet you'd get more than 10, and Mikhail here said you wouldn't."
"Careful, Lee,"
murmured Hester.
"So you gentlemen are of a sporting persuasion,"
Lee said, taking no notice of her.
"Best thing I've encountered today. What do you say to a game of cards, now this delicious repast is but a fading memory and our fair companion has withdrawn? Unless you'd like to take a chance on Flippity Flop."
"Nothing would please me more. But I have an appointment to take a portrait of the local headmaster and his family. I can't afford to miss it."
"And as for me, I'm going to a meeting at the town hall. The mayoral election is hotting up. I need to see which way it's going to go."
"Well, this is an exciting town, and no mistake. I can barely contain my exuberance."
Would you care to step along to the town hall and join me in the audience?"
said the economist.
"I believe I would,"
said Lee. And the other man's robin demon twitched her tail. The election meeting was certainly the place to be that evening. Men and women were making their way up the muddy street towards the town hall, which was brilliantly lit with gas lamps, Lee noticed with satisfaction. If there was a source of gas on the island, he'd be able to fill his balloon without too much difficulty, provided he could pay for it, of course. The people were dressed respectably, and so was Lee, to the extent of his one necktie, and they were talking with some animation.
"Is this the way they usually do politics on Novi Odense?"
Lee said to his companion.
"There is a great deal at stake in this election,"
said the economist, whose name, Lee had learned, was Mikhail Ivanovich Vasilyev.
"In fact, it's the reason I'm here. My academy is very interested in this man, Polyakov. He used to be a senator, but he hates to be reminded of the fact. He had to resign over a financial scandal, and he's using this mayoral election as a way of rehabilitating himself."
"Oh, is that so?"
said Lee, watching the crowd on the steps and noticing the uniformed stewards.
"I see there's a lot of customs men around. Are they expecting a ruckus?"
"Customs men?"
"The bullies. in the maroon uniforms.
Oh, they're not customs. That's the security arm of Larsen Manganese.
I keep hearing that name. Who are they?
Very big mining corporation. If Polyakov gets in, they will prosper. Rumor has it that the company has been looking for a confrontation with the customs. It's happening elsewhere throughout the North. Private companies invading the public sphere. Security, they call it. What they mean is threat. I've heard they have a large gun that they're keeping secret, for example, and they'd love to provoke a riot and bring it into use. That gentleman is hailing you.
They were at the top of the steps leading to the main doors, but they couldn't move any further because of the crush. Lee turned to look where Vasiliev was pointing and saw the poet Oscar Sigurdsson waving and beckoning. Lee waved back, but Sigurdsson beckoned even more urgently.
Better go see what he wants,
he said, and made his way through the crowd. Sigurdsson's butterfly demon was fluttering round and round his head, and the poet was beaming with pleasure.
Mr. Scoresby, so glad to see you. Miss Polyakova, may I introduce Mr. Scoresby, the celebrated aeronaut?
Celebrated my tail,
muttered Hester, but the young lady at Sigurdsson's side had Lee's interest at once. She was about 18 years old, and a contrast in every way to the starched Miss Lund. Her cheeks were rosy, her eyes were large and black, her lips were soft and red, her hair was a mass of dark curls. Her demon was a mouse. Lee took her hand with pleasure.
Delighted to make your acquaintance,
he said, and swept off his hat as well as he could in the crush. Sigurdsson had been saying something.
I beg your pardon, Mr. Sigurdsson. I was unable to concentrate on your words because of Miss Polyakova's eyes. I wager you have dozens of young men come from all over the Northlands to gaze at your eyes, Miss Polyakova.
She let them fall for a moment as if in modesty, and then gazed up through her lashes. Sigurdsson plucked at Lee's sleeve.
Miss Polyakova is the daughter of the distinguished candidate for mayor.
Oh, is that right? Are we going to hear your father speak tonight, miss?
Yes, he will speak, I think.
Who's he up against in the election?
Oh, I don't know. I think two men, or perhaps one.
Lee looked at her closely while trying to muffle Hester's grumbling from inside his coat. Was this young lady genuinely slow-witted or just pretending to be? She smiled again. She must be teasing. Good. If she wanted to play, Lee was in the mood for that. The obstruction inside the door had been cleared, and the crowd was moving up the steps, marshalled by the Larsen Manganese security men. Miss Polyakova stumbled, and Lee offered his arm, which she took readily. Meanwhile, Sigurdsson was pressing close at his other side, saying something that Lee couldn't quite hear and wasn't interested in, because the closer he got to Miss Polyakova, the more he was aware of the delicate floral scent she was wearing. Or perhaps it was the fragrance of her hair. Or perhaps it was just the sweet fact of her young body pressed against his side. Anyway, Lee was intoxicated.
What did you say?
He said to Sigurdsson reluctantly. The poet had been plucking at his other arm and was eagerly gesturing for Lee to bend his head as if to receive a confidence.
I said you might be able to make yourself useful to Olga's father,
Sigurdsson murmured as they entered the main hall. The place was set out with wooden chairs, and the platform was decorated with bunting and banners bearing the slogan Polyakov for Progress and Justice.
You don't say.
I'll introduce you after the meeting.
Well, thanks.
Lee's attitude to fathers was that he preferred to keep them at a distance. Fathers did not want their daughters doing what Lee had in mind. But before he could think of an excuse, he found himself in the front row where all the seats were reserved.
I can't sit here. These seats are for important guests.
But you are an important guest.
Oh, do stay, Mr. Scoresby.
Damn fool,
muttered Hester, but only Lee heard her, as she intended. They had hardly sat down when a stout official came out onto the stage and announced that they were closing the doors because the great desire of the people to hear the candidate speak meant that the hall was already full beyond its legal capacity, and they couldn't let anyone else in. Lee looked around and saw people standing 3 deep at the back and around the sides of the auditorium.
He's a popular man, your father, no doubt about that. What's his main policy? What's he going to do when he gets into office?
Bears,
she said with a delicate shudder, and made a face expressive of polite horror.
Oh, bears, eh? He doesn't like bears.
I'm scared of bears.
Well, that's understandable. They're pretty big, after all. I never dealt with your special Arctic bears, but I was chased by a grizzly once over in the Yukon.
Oh, how frightful! Did he catch you?
And once again, Lee felt as if he'd missed the bottom step in the dark. Could she really be this stupid? Was she doing it on purpose?
Well, he did. But it turned out the old fella only wanted to borrow a griddle to cook up a salmon he'd caught. I was agreeable to that, and we sat around yarning over supper. He drank my whiskey and smoked my cigars, and we promised to keep in touch. But I lost his address.
Oh, that's a pity. But you know...
Lee scratched his head, but he didn't have to think of anything else to say, because at that point, a group of three men came onto the stage and the whole audience stood to applaud and cheer. Lee had to stand as well, or seem conspicuously rude, and he looked around for his boarding house acquaintance. But among all the faces bright with fervour, the eyes ablaze with enthusiasm, he couldn't spot him anywhere. As they sat down again, Sigurdsson said,
"Wonderful response. Promises very well, wouldn't you say?"
"Never seen anything like it,"
said Lee. He settled back to listen to the speeches.